little challenge for you, Sark, a new recruit. It's a tough case, but I want him treated in the usual manner. Train him for the games, let him hope for a while, and blow him away.
You got it. I've been hoping you'd send me somebody with a little bit of guts. What kind of program is he?
He's not any kind of program, Sark. He's a user.
A user?
That's right. He pushed me in the real world. Somebody pushes me, I push back, so I brought him down here. What's the matter, Sark? You look nervous.
Well, I... It's just... I don't know, a user, I mean... Users wrote us. A user even wrote you!
No one user wrote me. I'm worth millions of their man years.
What if I can't?
You'd rather take your chances with me? Want me to slow down your power cycles for you?
Wait! I need that!
Then pull yourself together. Get this clown trained. I want him in the games until he dies playing. Acknowledge.
Acknowledge, Master Control.
End of line.
Any self-respecting child of the 80s has at least a dozen or so arcade stories to tell. From the deafening cacophony of digital burps and blips that overpower even your bitchin' new Sony Walkman cassette player, to the genial, nerdy trash talk, and even the minor scuffles that would break out over whose quarter was actually next in line atop the game's marquee. Is now referred to as the Golden Age, a time which arcades were not only mall staples, but congregations of machines could be found in department stores, bars, gas stations. A kid's vernacular was filled with words like Galaga, Dig Dug, and Q-Bert. And tonight's film attempted to capitalize on that zeitgeist, featuring extensively groundbreaking computer graphics in which the film world had never seen. Good evening and welcome to another edition of Natsukashi, where we greedily gobble nostalgia like Pac-Man on a bender. My name is Rob. I will serve as your host. And joining me on this tricked-out light cycle is none other than Count Vargelon. Count, how are you this evening? I see you have your little safety helmet on. You're ready to play.
I am completely ready to play, and I've got to say, I just wanted to stop and pause and reflect on the idea that we are talking over the internet about Tron.
I know. How funny is that?
How cool. How cool is that?
It's so perfect.
How appropriate.
And that third voice you hear, I'm jumping the gun a little bit here, but Jeff Bridges and Bruce Boxleitner starred as the two preposterously good-looking gamers. But proving that video games ain't just a man's world is tonight's featured guest, Miss Cindy Morgan, to discuss her role as Dr. Laura Baines and her bodysuit-hugging computerized counterpart, Yori. Good evening, Cindy.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
We are fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yes. Are you kidding me? There's two geeks talking to a geek goddess. So.
The Yori. Yeah, the geek goddess. That's very cute.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
All right, now we take you 3 months later. Dillinger presents Ancom with 5 video games that he's invented. The slime didn't even change the names, man. He gets a big, fat promotion. And thus begins his meteoric rise to, what is he now, executive VP?
Senior exec.
Senior exec? Meanwhile, the kids are putting 8 million quarters a week into paranoid machines. I don't see a dime except what I squeeze out of here.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Look, I'm going to cut to the chase very quickly on this one. Lots and lots of things are on the internet right now as far as Tron Legacy is concerned. Where are you on that? Are you in?
My understanding is going to be I just know that the film industry, as are many, all industries, are controlled by the fans now. The fans have the bottom line say.
Yes.
The internet, it's a media-determined society today, and it's controlled by the internet. So the fans have the last word. And my good friend Bill Caruth, who edited the film Caddyshack, you may have heard, another little film I was in, talked about a film he called Jaws. He was one of the last editors on Jaws, and he literally hot-spliced footage into the first screening of Jaws right before the first film screening in Dallas because it was wrong, and they hot splicing means literally cutting with a razor, taping it, new footage back in. So anything is possible. All I know is I've got good friends at Disney, and my phone still works, so I'm just hanging on.
Okay, all right. So they could put you in like
PD enough for you.
They could put you in like Fight Club style, like Tyler Durden did Fight Club. So,
sure.
Good. Okay. Well, I hope that this will help push it over the edge. We will certainly certainly tell all our listeners to make that push to have Yuri come back in her lovely glowy spandex bodysuit and toss the frisbee around a little bit this go round. So.
Oh, I've got to get my hands on the frisbee this time. Now that just was the only time my hands were on it was were in some publicity stills, but.
Yeah.
I talked to another group of bloggers, Action Chick Flicks, and when they heard that I wasn't allowed to fight in the film, they just really wanted to talk about that, and it would be really cool. It would be great. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Or well, Cal, let's go to you first. You were young, you were male, and you were breathing in the 80s. So I assume
He sounds like he was about 5 in the 80s. I'm not sure.
Well. I assume that you've played a video game or two in that era. So tell us your stories and what led you to Tron, obviously.
Oh, well, let's see. Yes, I was a nerd throughout the 80s, and some might say still am, and I was the exact right age for Tron. And I adored the Tron video game, which I played long before I ever saw the movie.
Okay.
It was one of the most it was the most fantastic game of its time. It had an amazing cabinet. It had 4 completely different games in it. It was just an incredible deal. And, yeah, I was a video game nerd. I had an Atari.
Sure.
I played Friends in Televisions and a Coleco. You know, I mean, I was all over it. So the idea of having a movie out there for video game people about video games, it was almost too good to be true. Mm-hmm. Then I finally managed to see Tron, and, yeah, for, you know, a 6-year-old, that did not disappoint. Now,
yeah, it wasn't far off when I guessed your age, was
it? It was such an overwhelming film for me as a child. Sadly, I did not get to see it in theaters because I was a little too young to see it in theaters. But even
it's so different in theaters. This is one that really needs to be seen in a theater because the graphics were designed for theaters.
Yeah.
And on a television, you can sort of get it, but in a theater, it's very overwhelming.
Yeah. I had an uncle who had a big screen television, and that was the closest
got.
One of the things I'm most excited about with Tron Legacy coming down the pipe is I assume my local repertory theater, before it comes out, is going to get Tron back to promote it. So I can't wait for the chance to see that one on the big screen.
Awesome.
Okay, come here. I'm going to put him at my terminal. I'm going to meet you in your office upstairs.
And don't fall asleep. If and when I activate your Tron program, you're only going to have a few minutes to use it before Dillinger catches a break in security, all right?
As long as we stay off the top floor, Dillinger will never know we've been in here.
Good luck, Hotshot.
Cindy, this was one of your first roles.
Yeah.
And extensive work was done on a blue screen.
Nope, no blue screen.
Oh.
It was shot in black and white.
Black and white, okay,
That's something a lot of folks don't know, and I don't blame you for saying that, because I've done blue screen and green screen work before.
Right.
I used to do the weather, not very well, in Rockford, Illinois. This was my second, I didn't even know what the damn oceans were. My director would come down with a dry marker and write Atlantic, Pacific. Nobody really cared, as long as they kept talking. I think they tuned in just to see what the hell I'd say.
Right.
Tron was my second job. Okay. My second job to Caddyshack. And I didn't work for a long time after Caddyshack. We spoke about that earlier because of a little altercation I had with a producer. And Tron was my next job. And it was shot in black and white with the old Panavision cameras that I was told since the cinematographer, actually, I just ran into last summer for the first time. He's working with my friend Bill Kruth, the film editor. He's now the professor teaching cinematography at Florida State University. So he was sitting behind me at a screening, and he taps me on the shoulder and goes, "Hey, you know who I am?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't." He goes, "Hey, you know who I am?" I said, "Sir, really? I really don't know who you are." And he kept poking me, and I said, "All right, who the hell are you?" And he said, "I was the cinematographer, John." I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "But I hate to tell you, you are the man behind the camera. You could see me, but I couldn't see you."
Right.
Anyway, it was all shot in black and white, and he was the one who told me it was shot with the old Panavision cameras they used for Lawrence Arabia. So this was, and it was shot, the entire set. Sound stages are just empty warehouses. Entire thing was black.
run these guys into your jet walls.
Copy, Blue Leader.
Copy, Blue Leader.
This is Gold 1 to Gold 2 and 3.
Split up. Take them one on one.
Disney, when this first was released in 1982, excuse me, I think it was an $11 million budget, somewhere around that area.
Disney didn't consult with me, but that would sound right. I think it was more than that, I'll be honest with you.
Okay. I know it was in the double digits. So,
yeah.
And they pinned a lot of hopes and money on this film. Because it was a first-time director, first-time producer, and it was only moderately successful upon its release. But, of course, as you know...
There are a lot of stories about why and what, and yeah, oh, gosh, I did it. It got the cover of Time Magazine. I did the Tonight Show to promote it. I did the press junket, so I know exactly what their hopes were. You betcha.
Right. And I guess by their standards, maybe it underwhelmed. But then, as most films that we cover on this podcast do, it exploded once it hit VHS and once it hit cable, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And I read a quote from you in the past that you had no idea the impact that this would have. Now looking back on it so many years later, almost three decades later, what do you think about this?
Well, it's astonishing that it held up over time. My understanding is, and I've heard many rumors between people who were in the know, was that Tron had legs until a particular reviewer in the Wall Street Journal had something negative to say about it because he just didn't get it. And that happened with a lot of people. Some people just don't get it.
Right.
The rumors I heard were a lot of the promotion was pulled, maybe the stock took a little dip, and people lost faith in it. So, as often the case, people didn't go to what they were told not to go to, and then they didn't get it. So I never read a critic's review before I go to a movie. If I want to go see it, it's never as bad or as good as they say it is.
The best programmer Incom ever saw, and he winds up playing Space Cowboy in some back room.
Okay, let me handle this.
Go right ahead.
Have you been sneaking into the Incom system?
God, never were much for small talk, were you? She still leave her clothes all over the floor?
Flynn.
No.
Alan!
Well, I mean, not that often.
Now you can see why all of his friends are 14 years old.
Touche.
It's not show business anymore. It's show business. They're making mech movies.
Right.
Yeah. But like McDonald's. They put together a formula, and that way the movie will work. And I was just talking to Randy Waggy, who we both know today, and I said, you can't put together the formula to make it work. There's a human element, and that's where that movie magic comes from. And if a bunch of guys sit there, and because I was on the other side of the desk as producers, and my jaw dropped when I heard them say, well, if you just do this and this and this, it'll work. And I'm like, yeah, but you're leaving out what happens when you actually get to the set and you put these elements together.
Right.
So Tron actually was good for one particular reason, and it had legs for it lasted, because the director, writer, Steven Lisberger, held true to his vision. And that was, I remember telling Steven, I was a sound engineer, an FCC licensed sound engineer. I should understand. I have a small technical background. I don't know what the hell I'm saying. I don't know what I'm saying. How's anybody else going to know? And he said the movie's not for them.
Someone with that access has been tampering.
I hope you don't think it's me. I don't even balance my checkbook on downtime. I have an abacus at home for that.
Oh, yes, I'm sure you understand. It should only be a couple of days. What's the project you're working on?
Well, it's called Tron. It's a security program itself, actually. It monitors all contacts between our system and other systems. Finds anything going on that's not scheduled, it shuts it down. I sent you a memo on it.
Part of the master control program?
No. It'll run independently. You can watchdog the MCP as well.
Sounds good. Well, we should have you running again in a couple of days, I hope.
I gotta ask you a related question about that, because sure. I wanted to know how you felt about all of the scientific terms, because, I mean, as a kid, I'll admit, it kind of all went over my head, but going back and watching it now, and just seeing the film from beginning to end, I'm amazed at how little is explained to the audience. Like, they never sit down and Yeah, and I really impressed by being respected for it, but what amazed me even more was that they were talking about concepts in there, and you want to talk about ahead of its time, for which that I don't even know if there were words for in 1982. Like,
right.
When Bruce Boxleitner is explaining what Tron is, he's talking about a firewall or antiviral program.
Right.
But he doesn't use that word because I don't think that word existed yet.
No, I remember I was walking back from lunch with Steven Lisberger, and I said, I don't know what I'm saying. And he said, the movie's not for them. I said, but Steven, if people don't understand it, will they go to the movie? And he said, and he was very adamant about holding true to his vision. And that's why I held up over time, because he was right in the respect that there was a purity in his concept. He really believed it, and the human element was really real in it. And what happened was Jeff Bridges, Bruce Boxleitner and myself, and of course David Warner and Barnard Hughes, they put us in a room and a completely black soundstage, and we found the reality of what we were talking about in each other's eyes. You get the script, you look at each other, and you commit to what you're saying, except for one line. One line, I pulled my punch on. I said, Stephen, I won't say this line. He made me say it. And to this day, the audience knows which line I'm not saying with conviction, because they laugh every time I say it. You know which one it is?
It was the circuitry one, wasn't it? Your circuit's not
big
enough.
Yes, the one. When I say, Tron, I knew there wasn't a circuit built that could hold you.
Yeah.
The audience cracks up every single time, because they can see it in my eyes. You can't lie to the audience.
Right.
And the audience is looking at me going, because in my mind I'm going,
this is nonsense.
And I'm not committing to the lie. And that's what, you got to be telling the truth.
Yeah.
What amazed me, and I think why it worked for me when I was young and works for me just as well now, is that you're right, it works on a human level even if you don't understand the technology. You always know exactly what
Absolutely.
The stakes are. You always know exactly who these people are. You don't need to know what all these words mean.
You're getting brutal, Sark. Brutal and needlessly sadistic.
Thank you, Master Control.
We kidnapped some military programs. I can arrange more illegal matches. Interested?
Sure. I'd love to go up against one of those guys. Make a nice break from those accounting cream puffs you keep sending me. What branch of the service?
Strategic Air Command.
Nice.
When David Warner looked at me and told me I was going to die, that was not acting. When that man looks at you in the eye and says you're going to die, you believe him, buddy. I mean, there's no point. He is one of the strongest and most intimidating people I've ever worked with. Whereas Barnard Hughes was probably one of the most kind men I've ever worked with. And Jeff and Bruce, obviously very, very strong leading men characters. And, you know, when you guys were little kids, you know, and you played games in the street with each other, you didn't have to have all the props. You believed what you did. Because you just did. And that's how we did that job. There was nothing there. When I flew the Solar Sailor across the game sea, I walked into the sound, because I stopped reading the script. I was like, don't even tell me. I'm just going to walk in and show me where I'm going and what I'm doing. I don't even want to know anymore. So I would just walk in and to this black sound stage, and there was a black riser that day. You know, it's a little raised platform, all black. And on it was a little black, one of those little banquet tables, 8 by, you know, those little 8 foot tables, you know, and it's covered with black felt. And this day, Steven Lisberger says, okay, Morgan, get on the Solar Sailor, you're crossing the game seat, go. And I looked at him, I said, okay. I raised my hand. I said, all right, I just got to ask you, what the hell are you talking about? And you know, I said, I usually don't ask, you know, I try not to ask you, but what? There's nothing here. And I don't want to be the one to tell you this, but there's nothing here.
Right.
And he said, all right, so he showed me the wonderful Sydney graphics. He said, this is what it's going to look like. It's crossing the game sea. And then he said, now fly the ship. And I said, okay, Stephen, just one little point here. There's nothing. This is a black table. What? Anything in particular you'd like me to do? He goes, fly the ship. They'll put things in under you. I was a sound engineer in radio. You knew that. I ran my own board. In my mind, that table became my soundboard.
This Solar Sailor simulation will take us across the game sea, out of this domain, back into the central computer.
This is a good segue, because, Cindy, I read in a previous interview that your favorite film is Journey to the Center of the Earth, and your favorite
it is, yeah.
And your favorite book is The Mists of Avalon. So do I sense...
I do like that.
Do I sense an inner nerd trying to break free?
I was accepted to the Illinois Institute of Technology, which is the West version of MIT, when I got out of an all-girls Catholic high school. I wanted to be an engineer. like my dad, and I went to the open house, and it was all guys and four girls that year, and I chickened out. I wanted to go to a technology school, and IIT is like MIT in Illinois. My highest grades were in science and math. I didn't like math. I loved science. I didn't like math particularly, but I went to a liberal arts college instead, Northern University, and that made all the difference. I went in with a stammer, couldn't talk, literal stammer, and that got me into, I was a terrible speaker, but a good writer, and that got me into broadcasting, because everything I was afraid of after that point, the inner nerd wanted to conquer all those fears, and after that, that got me into broadcasting. When I got as far as I could go, which is doing morning drive in Chicago, which is at the time is the second or third arguably largest market in the country, and I could only make $135 a week doing morning drive. The heck with this, I need to do commercials, and they wouldn't let me. They thought I was a radio person. I didn't belong on camera. I said, the hell with you guys? I'm going to L.A. And I got an Irish Spring commercial. And after that, they said, you know, they sent me on some auditions, and I picked up Caddyshack and then Trump.
Okay.
So, yeah, internet, the answer, the short version is yes.
Like the man says, there's no problems, only solutions.
Okay, remember, this laser is my life's work. Don't spill anything. Huh? Have fun, sweetheart.
All right, so Count and Cindy, both of you, do you guys have a favorite old-school video game?
I wish it wasn't sounding like I was this, you know, cloying and kiss-uppy, but it really is the Discs of Tron game, which is just, it was the most amazing experience of video gaming of my childhood.
Okay.
If the Tron movie didn't make any money from me on video or theater, it made a lot of money from me from that video game. Because I got good
really?
Over a long period of time. Oh, I must have spent $50 to $100 on that video game alone.
All right, Cindy.
Well, they had video games on the set of Tron. They all black set, nothing there, but over on the side, and I'm glad they did, because it was, you know, it would get exhausting psychologically just to sit in a black soundstage for 8 to 10 hours a day.
Sure.
Space Invaders was very hot at the time, and I think, quite frankly, I was as good as any one of the guys. I got to be honest with you. But that's what we would do. We were playing video games while we were waiting for the next scene set up.
Well, that's good. Obviously, that's good inspiration for all the characters, I would think, then, to be able to...
Oh, yeah. Good idea.
Practice what you preach. Yeah.
Yeah, get inside the real mindset of the story.
You shouldn't have come back, then.
Hey, hey, hey. It's the big master control program everybody's been talking about.
Sit right there. Make yourself comfortable. Remember the time we used to spend playing chess together? That isn't going to do you any good, Flynn. I'm afraid. Stop. Please. You realize I can't allow this.
Now, how are you going to run the universe if you can't even answer a few unsolvable problems? Huh? Come on, big fella. Let's see what you got.
I'd like to go against you and see what you're made of.
You know, you don't look a thing like your pictures.
I'm warning you. You're entering a big era, Flynn. I'm going to have to put you on the game, Brid.
Games. You want games? I'll give you games.
Seeing it in widescreen for the first time when I bought the DVD recently, and I got to say, it's a great DVD. Like, all the special features is just incredible. When I watched it, is like, there's all sorts of stuff you miss there, and the weird satirical thing in that at the very beginning of the movie, when Bruce Boxleitner goes to David Warner's office, there's this shot that never made sense of a guy asking if he can have his popcorn. And I, as a kid, never understood what that shot was doing there. But seeing it widescreen, it's like this huge panorama of a cubicle farm, which might have been the first reference to that I'd ever seen in fiction.
Right.
You know, like the future, the way offices were designed. And that was the one thing that really... And obviously there's a Pac-Man hidden in the movie if you see it widescreen, which I never had.
Absolutely. There's a Mickey Mouse hidden on the game.
There's a Mickey Mouse?
There's a Mickey Mouse head, as I understand. These guys who were drawing these graphics just got crazy after a while and were, like, embedding little crazy things. Yeah, there's supposedly a Mickey head across the game scene someplace.
Really?
You betcha. Yeah, go ahead. And there's also from when the Earth stood still. What is this? They told the robot to
Gort.
Yeah, what did they, Klaus...
Klaus Barada Nitto.
That's on the wall of somebody's office in that scene.
Okay, that's actually pretty cool.
Awesome.
I didn't even notice that. But what I wanted to ask you was, the strange thing about the film was that it really has a great pace. I didn't remember that it took a half hour before he actually gets into the computer, which is interesting to start with. The last 15 minutes of that movie seemed really rushed. Was there an issue with how much time it was taking to film? Did they have to cut stuff? Because once you guys get on the scenes start moving very quickly, and then the showdown with the master control program all happens, and the movie's over within like 3 or 4 minutes. Like, it's...
I think it just was a case of how the editor at the end put it together. This was in post-production for many, many months because of all the graphics, you know, because it was the first CGI film ever, many, many months in post-production. And a lot of this was sent overseas to do. So when they got it back, I think they just worked with what they had. Personally, they probably should have reshot, but given the fact that it would have been such a time-intensive process, they didn't. They might have put in an editor always will ask for a pickup scene here or there to make it work out better. And I don't think they had that opportunity because of the post-production process on this.
Tron, location query. Confirm.
Confirmed, Alan Watt.
I am creating the information on your disk that will erase the MCP and change the system. Dedicate yourself to getting the disk into the heart of the MCP. This interface is located at its base. We will not be able to communicate again unless you succeed. Go.
It was at one point, one of the toughest things was on the Solar Sailor. Jeff Bridges, Bruce Boxleitner, and myself are looking in three different directions, of course. And he said, you got to look at the same thing. And I said, all right, there's nothing. I got tired of filling him. There's nothing there. I said, do me a favor. Get one of the grips, one of the guys working on the film, to drag a roll of gaffer's tape. I know there's gaffer's tape everywhere. On a little string, and just drag it. And we'll all look at the same thing. And what we were looking at is a roll of tape.
And you, wait, that was your idea? Because
somebody had to speak up. And we're looking at three different places.
No, it's amazing to me because, you know, you hear now, it's so commonplace to hear, you know, actors talking about how weird it was to stand in front of a green screen and watch some guy holding up a ping pong ball and have to look at that and
see
a dinosaur. And you were the first person to have to do that. That's just so incredible.
I had worked green screen before and television and blue screen. I was familiar with the thing, but I also was familiar with the fact that if you want us to look at the same thing, put one thing there and I'll look at it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, I came from a broadcast background, and I'm so glad I did because I had to run camera. I had to run sound. I was on the other side of it. So, I might have had more of a cruise mentality when it was problem solving. But it was fun to do.
Now Flynn is saying to look over in here, but I don't see what we're looking for.
Tell us your most interesting fan-related story that you, or, you know, interesting / amusing, possibly scary, because...
We'll stay away from the scary. I'll tell you what, when you're an actor in the film industry, you go to work, you do your job, and you come home. I had no idea 30 years later, and I always remember thinking, when I was appreciating film, and I was appreciating different things, I was like, God, how cool is it to do something that lasted over time? That's something that really holds up. How cool is that? When people come and speak to me and they say, you know, I saw this or I saw, and they have specific moments in obscure pieces of work that I've done that I didn't think anybody saw. And
right.
they knew what I was thinking and they knew what I was doing. And I'm like, all right, I'm doing my job. I'm doing my best. You know, if the director doesn't see it, the producer, up to hell with them. I'm going to do the best thing I can. You know, and when a fan comes up and says, I saw when you did that, you know, I saw when you did that. And that meant, and that you have no idea how many people have come up and said they've gotten into computer work because of the movie Tron.
In many ways, Tron kind of defined the way an entire generation thinks about computers. Like, when we imagine, when I know when I do, and I know that everyone I talk to, when they imagine what the inside of a computer looks like, they're thinking of Tron. In the same way that a new generation thinks of, the generation after mine thinks of The Matrix, we think of Tron when we think of what computers are.
I remember when I was doing the press junket for Tron, and I kept getting asked the same question. I mean, it was just too funny. It was like, well, aren't you afraid now that you'll be replaced, actors will be replaced by computers? I said, no. And they said, well, why not? I said, because I can do one thing computers can't do. And they said, what's that? And I said, I can make mistakes. That's what makes it interesting. That gives it the human element. That's what it is. And whatever mistake that is, that's what makes that particular role unique.
You're telling me that Woody and Buzz didn't actually make mistakes in Toy Story? Because I saw the blooper reel at the end of that.
You're right. I defer to the blooper reel at the end of Toy Story. You're right.
You make a really excellent point there, and I've never heard it phrased that way. That simply put, like, a computer program will always do exactly what you tell it to, and that's not how you get
art. I have to go back to Caddyshack, but I remember Harold Ramis, the director, saying, Cindy, what are all these things you're doing that aren't in the movie? And Bill Carruth, the editor, said, Harold, that's going to be your movie. Do you think any of those things Bill Murray said that came out of his mouth about the Dalai Lama were in the script? I'm wondering if anything that came out of Billy's mouth was in the script.
I must have gotten in there by mistake.
Who programmed you?
I was
You're in trouble, program. Make it easy on yourself. Who's your user?
Forget it, Mr. High and Mighty Master Control! You are making me talk!
Suit yourself.
I see the game over sign flashing on the screen, but before we enter our initials... Before we enter our initials on the high scoreboard, I want to thank Dan, whose musings you can catch on Vargelon.com. I also want to thank our guest, Miss Cindy Morgan, and you can check her out on CindyMorgan.com as well, too.
CindyMorganInfo.com. CindyMorganInfo.com. CindyMorgan.com is owned by a bot in Asia, I think.
As always, it's entertaining and informative. Interview with you, and I really, really appreciate it.
Cool, and I love your approach. It's very unique. It's very fresh, and that's what makes it so much fun for me.
In the jungle, I run tonight. Find the beast that lies in the light. No confusion, just run the right. Faces, numbers, all recognize. You don't fool me with sugar, the lies. No problems, no compromise.